Okay, so this is the sixth week of our investigation of the 20th century fundamentalist modernist controversy, which has been the subject since we started in March. Now remember, the modernists, called liberals, have abandoned the authority of Scripture. They're cut loose. But the modernists have not ceased to be religious. They keep on being religious. In fact, they kind of double down on morality and are strong for God, culture, and the country. Kind of, you know, but without the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ in it, they're still Christians. They have been theologically removed. That's not us. That's them. Okay. So we have, that's the modernist side of it, and we're the fundamentalist side. Although I go through through these discussions, and I say, I don't know that I can pick a side that describes who we are, which really is scary. Maybe it's good, I don't know. But so we're certainly not the modernist or the liberal side of this equation, and we're kind of on the other side of it too, but I'm not sure I want to be there either, so that's what I'm saying. So we got up last week in the aftermath of the Scopes trial, all the good things that happened, the quality of, if I call it quality of Christianity that was being developed after the Scopes trial was really astounding, probably the highlight, high point of the evangelicalism in that we are aware of that's been a recorded history during these 50 years. And we came to the point about talking about radio, and I said that's going to take longer than I have time to finish, so we want to pick that up now because it's an important part of it. Now remember, as a fundamentalist lost the battle to include creationism in the textbook. Remember, they won in keeping evolution out, but they didn't win to put creationism in, which as far as I'm concerned in public schools, that's fine because we're not talking about science anyway. We're talking about religious convictions and revelation information, which brings you to creationism. So they don't have it. That's fine. But in a sense, the Lord gave us another tool, even better one, that the Lord delivers a new present in a new platform to spread the good news to the whole family, not just to the kids in school. God gives the AM radio to the evangelists to spread the Bible truths through the country, actually throughout the whole world. And it happened about the same time that the Scopes trial ends. Now, a little about radio here. On Christmas Eve 1906, my father-in-law's birthday, that's year, I should say, Regeland Festenden, however you say his name, used a synchronous rotary spark transmitter, which I have no idea what that is, but he used it for the first time to broadcast a radio program from Massachusetts. Ships at sea obviously had some kind of radio to receive it, heard a broadcast that included the Fressenden playing O Holy Night, nice choice, on the violin and reading a passage from the Bible, probably would have been Christmas story, I would guess. And is that not a nice choice to put on the first airwaves, something for the Bible, something Christian? This was, for all intents and purposes, the first transmission of what is now known as amplitude modulation, or AM radio. And I put it on the top. That's new. Beginning in 1926, the Federal Radio Commission regulated radio use in the United States. That's 20 years later. It took a while to build these sets, to have people in the home and build stations, all that kind of stuff. The Radio Act of 1927 gave the Federal Radio Commission power to grant and deny licenses and to assign frequencies and power levels for each licensee. Remember, they don't want to interfere with each other because no one gains when you have that. In 1928, it began requiring licenses of existing stations that were built without license and setting controls on who could broadcast from where and on what frequency and at what power. But there was no control over the content of the broadcast. The Communications Act of 1934 abolished the Federal Radio Commission and replaced it with the now well-known FCC. The first radio or Christian broadcast was from an Episcopal church or entity out of Pittsburgh in 1921, followed closely by Moody Bible Institute's Paul Rader, who's the pastor, of the Moody Church in 1922. Yes, and the first nationwide preaching on radio. And he was a songwriter. Interesting. I get these little tidbits on the side that I thought you might be interested in. He wrote the song Only Believe, All Things Are Possible, Only Believe. And it was a favorite of Elvis Presley. Now, you came all the way to hear that. You know, Elvis Presley grew up on hymnology. Those are his favorite songs. And there are people that will still die that he's a believer. I'm going to leave that up to the Lord. I won't argue. But he understood, you know, the hymns. So Fuller was saved. Charles E. Fuller was saved under Raiders ministry. Now remember, Fuller is in California, Raiders in Chicago. So what I don't know is where all did Raider go? Apparently there were these itinerant evangelists that went to places to preach. We talked about the Bible Conference movement. That still continued on. And it's very possible that in one of these contacts, or it could be that Fuller, as a younger man, was in the Chicago area. I don't know the answer to that, but he was saved under Raider's ministry, 1916. 9 years later, Fuller was on the radio with his own program. Think about that. Maybe you know Amy Semple McPherson. She is the founder of the Four Square Gospel Church. I don't know if there's one in Lincoln anymore or not. There was one on North 33rd. Not a very large church, charismatic church. Called Full Gospel Churches. I imagine it's still around somewhere. Anyway, she was a popular Christian evangelist in the 1920s who saw the potential of radio to spread her message, formed the gospel church. In 1922, she became the first woman to broadcast a sermon over the radio waves. I'm not sure that means anything to anybody, but it's just one interesting thing. A year later, her Santa Monica-based church, the Angelus Temple, inaugurated the 500-watt station KFSG. All right, so now the church has a station. So this station was the first to be owned by a local church. Followed quickly, closely by schools like Biola in 1922, Moody Bible Institute in 1925, and many others. I didn't start chasing this down. It wasn't a study about that. But there was a lot of radio stations being built. Remember, I said that they couldn't get it to the textbooks. God is giving them another tool. At first, the Christian programming was over-established networks. Mutual would have been a little bit later, but I just list these as networks, American Broadcasting Company. We still know that as ABC. And radio exploded over the nation. Christian radio programming was readily available. And I was thinking about to my youth in our area, and you maybe could tell your own stories. In our area in central Nebraska, I remember we had KMMJ out of Grand Island. And by the way, I find out today that they are a Christian broadcasting station. I did not know that. But it came on the air in 1926, and I remember my grandpa, Peter Under, my mother told me these things, I don't know him. My grandpa undertook the men's chorus to sing live from their studio in Grand Island, and they received response from as far away as Canada. So we didn't have all these channels, you know, interfering, and I don't know what wattages there were, but since there weren't interference from other stations, they're carried far. But KGSK in Columbus, Nebraska, they still are on the air, I think. It was a Christian broadcasting a little bit later, 1948. And we, as young people, traveled to that station and sang over their live programming as well. So it was a Christian station. You would have things like Back to the Bible broadcasts and a host of other, which I was going to sort of remember what these all were. Then KMA, Shenandoah in Iowa, another, not a Christian station necessarily, but they broadcast Christian things. And they are still owned by the original owners. And I'm not sure what that means. It can't mean they're the same people, but maybe the same entity still own it, maybe like a family. And even our Lexington station, KRVN, had religious broadcasting. So broadcasting was really kind of everywhere and much more available, I don't know, than today, because we have a lot available as well. But there was none that was no FM at that time in this part of the country, just AM. And now in our own fair city, the Back to the Bible broadcast with Reverend Theodore Epp starting it on KFOR 1936, and it became international before his retirement. Remember, they did 5 half-hour programs a week. They were on 800 stations, and in 1981, when he retired, Epp's broadcast stations exceeded Fuller's by, I think Fuller had 650, up at 800. Remember, Fuller did 1 hour at the end, 1 hour a week, whereas Epps programming was five half hours a week, so more programming. All right, so here we have that, and the Back to Bible still exists in a form, but not doing what it was doing. Later, there were attempts to establish more radio and TV stations. We have KBHL. Are they still on air? Is that what, you know, when Gary Blackshear was here, he was here to get that up and going in other areas. Others in Aurora, the Rosehearts, even some of my brother's families own those stations. There's one in Orchard, Nebraska today, and the one that owned it, one at Aurora, the Christian station. So this is probably just an example where it was everywhere, how the Lord used radio. So even Indian Hills had a short foray in television and radio, and it was a very successful, especially the television. I'm going to tell you one story about a neighbor that we grew up with. His son listened to the program, the television program, one night, and he got saved. And his son got saved, and now he is ministering in Kansas. I don't know if you're going to give me his name. His last name is McNerney, but I can't remember his first name right now. So it's interesting how these things, I just happen to know about that one. There must have been others that we don't know about. So it was very expensive and very hard to maintain. So it was somewhat short-lived, but we had our day in the sun, so to speak. And it was effective while we had it. So we have then Carl McIntyre in the 50s and 60s fought with the FCC for the right to own his own station. All right, that's kind of the background of our study today. And we talk about Fuller began in 1925. And his death was in 1968, and I remember we moved to a place on East Avon, to get the right place here now, and there was a house system in the house, you know, like a radio, you know, speakers in the rooms, and I remember listening to Fuller in the morning before we go to church, and I said, is that really true? Well, we moved in 64, and he died in 68, so there were times when we were listening to him. All right, so, and we know about him. His song was Jesus Saves, Jesus Saves, Give the Winds a Mighty Voice. So anyway, 43 years of ministry. What a legacy. So Fuller was saved in 1916 under the ministry of Paul Rader at Moody Church. Fuller was a Presbyterian, but after attending the Bible training at Biola, where Reuben Torrey was the dean. And by the way, I read a short biography of Torrey today. That is a biography that's worth reading. What a remarkable man. He actually had his own awakening that would parallel in some ways Whitfield. I mean, it's worldwide. So very interesting story about him, Reuben Torrey. And he was one of the guys that wrote in Moody's cabin up in Massachusetts. I showed you some of that. Anyway, don't know these names, but this one's worth chasing down. Okay, so Fuller attends Biola, where Reuben Torrey was the dean, and probably, you might say, is converted to dispensationalism, because that's what the school was. And for the rest of his life, Fuller was a dispensationalist. Usually they go the other way, but, you know, that one didn't. And you see on the Fuller's little stand there, it says mutual, so obviously he's broadcasting through the Mutual Broadcasting Company. Now, I shouldn't stop and talk about it, because it's interesting how these guys would have carried the message, because the network wouldn't been like we have today. You have a line or satellite, you hook them up, and you have live. Those days, I know the Back to the Bible broadcast sent tapes to all these stations every day or every week, whatever. So it wasn't like they had a telephone line that was reliable. I'm not sure about that, just a question. Makes it more difficult. Some tidbits here about this whole thing. Charles Fuller was a pastor first with his own congregation in the Calvary Church at Placentia, California, about 1924. And I think he's sitting there in the middle in the front there with all the kids. I think that must be him. And this is an interesting part. A church plant also called Calvary Church of Santa Ana. And its first service was in 1931. And the church was officially chartered as an independent branch of the Calvary Church of Placentia. I can't say that. Huh? Yes, Fuller's Church. There you go. It's Fuller's Church. And you start out with 203 members. And we're not done yet. So we've had some pastors. Now we get into 1982. It says here this pastor, Sam Svick, dies. And after an interim ministry of Lehman Strauss. Remember who Lehman Strauss is? It was Gil's pastor. So he's an interim pastor there. And the guy that follows him is David Hocking, who still is alive. And he comes to the pre-trib conference. There's a picture if you don't remember who he is. So he served there for many years. So interesting, these connections. If we only knew of them all, we'd be surprised how many of this kind of connections there are out there. And I remember visiting Santa Ana Church when we were in California. We did a lot of that in the days when we were younger. And I remember being in that church, not for a service, but in the building. Okay, so the old-fashioned revival hour, the first nationwide broadcast occurred on October 1937. I was only a mere 3 months old. On the mutual broadcast system, beginning in 1951, the program was carried on the ABC network and heard over more than 650 stations, as we said. We got a picture here of Rudy Atwood at the piano, and the quartet really was out of a church in the Los Angeles area, and I don't know who the names are because I'm sure they would have rolled over, you know, from time to time. But we knew Rudy Atwood at the piano. Well, 1933, Fuller decided to concentrate his entire effort on radio ministry and his flagship program known as the Radio Revival Hour. In 1937, he purchased time on the new Mutual Broadcasting Network for an hour-long old-fashioned revival hour. In 1938, nationwide broadcast. In 1939, the show had 10 million weekly listeners who were organized into a loose-knit group of financial supporters. So this became like a faith mission. They sent in the money, and they were on the air. And I read places where, you know, it was like $14,000 a week to put these things on. So in those days, that's a lot of money. Now, the program, if you don't know anything about it, it's featured gospel, popular gospel songs. It's an hour long, performed by a professional choir. I'm not sure what that means. We have a professional choir, don't we, here? Fuller's homespun homilies, reading of letters by Gracie, and from the listeners who had been led to God through the broadcast. A lot of them were servicemen that wrote in. Many soldiers who were being shipped out to the Pacific Theater in World War II visited the Long Beach Auditorium for one last word of spiritual insight or encouragement. And I think many must have been saved there, as you would have thought about the end of their life. May was near going off as soldiers. The ministry's global listenership peaked at 20 million during the 40s, aired over powerful AM stations in Europe, South America, and Asia in subsequent years. Fuller set the pattern for future independent broadcast ministries that were wholly listener-supported and were focused on personal conversion. And we'll talk more about Fuller soon. So we come to the battle over the airwaves. Nothing's ever simple, is it? Well, the 1920s and 30s were a time of acrimony between the fundamentalist and the modernist Christians in the United States. That old fundamentalist liberal argument. Both factions sought to control the airwaves, and the early winners were the modernists. The U.S. Congress established the Federal Radio Commission, as we said. New regulations were issued by the commission for licensed stations and effectively closed down over half of the nation's radio ministries. Many of these were fundamentalist in orientation. So between 1927 and 1934, a movement emerged to reserve certain sections of the radio broadcast spectrum for educational, non-commercial, and religious programming. Now, I put this up here, just I'm sure you guys know all about this stuff here. But anyway, the radio spectrum is the same as light waves. It's a frequency. So these things are assigned, and there's only so much room. You can't have everybody have on the same frequency, so these have to be assigned. It's probably the job of the government to assign these out and make them fair. In the middle, we have long wave, medium wave, FM radio. We got things like we know now, like television. We have Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, microwave. All these are frequencies. The higher you get, you know, to the right, I guess that'd be for you too, to the right, the closer they get. You get the gamma rays and cosmic rays, all part of the light spectrum called the radio spectrum. So these are regulated, all right? So we have the argument that the liberals, in a sense, got their way and had a lot of these fundamentalist radio stations shut down. So the Wagner-Hatfield Amendment to the Communications Act of 1934 would have implemented a spectrum for special programming like religious broadcasting. It would have actually set aside a spectrum for that. But the amendment failed. However, a compromise plan allowed secular networks such as CBS, NBC to allocate a given amount of their free air time each week to public interest programming in place of losing entire segments of the radio broadcast spectrum. Says don't give it all up, but give some of it up, and we won't change anything. So this is how it was, and that's still how it is, I think, as far as I know today. So these allocations were called sustaining times. You think there should be an S on there, but that's what they call them. The sustaining time monopoly forced independent evangelicals and fundamentalists to purchase commercial time from such networks as the Mutual Broadcasting and ABC. The most successful of the independent evangelical programs was Charles Fuller. He paid, stepped up and paid it, and the old-fashioned revival hour was on the air. Fuller began his broadcast career in 1925, teaching Bible classes over the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, BIOLA, privately owned radio station of the school. By 1930, Fuller's Calvary Church Sunday worship service was being broadcast locally along with a popular phone-in show, during which Fuller answered listener questions. So the battle over the airways, the issue never dies. So this one you're more familiar with in our time. So this one goes, the rumors. We're talking about Madeline O'Hare, Murray O'Hare. Madeline is also also campaigning to remove all Christmas programming, Christmas songs, Christmas carols from public schools. This is a kind of a quote. You can help this time. We need 1 million signed letters. This should defeat Ms. Hare, and show that there are many Christians alive and well and concerned in our country. This petition is number 2493, sign cut off, mail the form below. Please do not sign jointly as Mr. and Mrs. Let each adult sign one separately and mail it in a separate envelope. Be sure to put the petition number 2493 on the envelope when mailing your letter. Please send the letter out to everyone that can help in this cause. I don't know how many times this letter went out to people. And every few years, you'd have another wave of this. The FCC is going to shut down Christian broadcasting or do something like she's got here. Well, if you want to know something, you go to Snoop's, right? Well, they're probably as good as any. Well, Snoop says, now for nearly four decades, more than 10 million letters, emails, phone calls later, the agency that deregulated telecommunication industry and helped usher in the communication revolution seems to have met defeat in its fight against this one rumor. It is one of the most fascinating urban myths that continues to grow. The FCC has no authority to ban religious programming. It literally is a myth, he said. Now, the truth or fiction side said of Madeline O'Hare, one of the reasons the FCC rumor is so believable is that Murray O'Hare shocked the nation more than two decades ago by participating in legal action that resulted in the United States Supreme Court decision pulling prayer and Bible reading out of the classrooms in the public school. There is a petition, and we give the number, but it was filed by, this is the truth supposedly, was filed by a couple of fellows who felt that churches and religious organizations should not be operating so many FM frequencies that are classified as educational. So they asked the FCC to take actions, including freezing all new applications from religious organizations seeking educational frequencies and regulating the content of religiously operated stations. This prompted religious broadcasters to ask for a public response, which is what they always do, to the FCC on the matter, and the FCC eventually issued a ruling that was favorable to the religious broadcasters. But once the rumor starts, you can't stop it. So this thing just went on and on and on and on and on. And it's not been around for a while. So it's kind of one of those things that just happened, and everybody's afraid that something's going to happen to our freedoms, especially Christian freedoms, and it doesn't take much to set us off. Now, I'm not a conspiracist, that some are, you know, some things see, you know, I'm not. I also know there's an devil out there trying to undo us too, so I'm not stupid either on that side, but be careful what you end up getting involved in. Now, O'Hare. It is an interesting twist that Madeline Murray O'Hare has been out of the picture, but this story keeps on rolling on. Since she disappeared in August of 1995, in January 2001, authorities in Texas found her remains in a shallow grave. And I read the story about this, really quite interesting. Killed by a criminal associate. By the way, Murray did keep evil companions for her at her disposal. So that one of them finally had a nut for her and did her in and some of her family. The way the secular media reported, Madeline Murray O'Hare, the famous atheist who got the Bible reading kicked out of public schools, was a national hero after the Supreme Court ruled in her favor. No wonder Christians believed the rumor. All right. Well, if Charles Fuller personified anything, it was of a well-meaning, caring, loving father who would plead for your soul and not offend. Who ever heard him preach? One, two, four? Really? I thought there might be some more. I'm sure you can get it on the internet. I mean, you want to hear him preach, you can do that. Very low. I just described him. That's how he sounded. Seemed like it would never be a harsh word. Carl McIntyre was in everything the opposite.
Amen.
Thank you, Charlie. It would not be an overstatement that what separated these two men would be McIntyre's bellicose style. Amen. The message of the gospel was the same, producing the same results, yet delivered very differently. So are you either the son of God or children of the devil? It kind of depends on where you are. You know, so that was definitely there. And you see McIntyre usually pictured with a megaphone. Now, whether that was his, but he's got signs, you know, political signs. So that's who he was. Charles Fuller was everything the opposite of that. But in the run-up to and after the forming of the National Association of Evangelicals, NAE, 1942, and the definition of the neo-evangelicals in the frame from 1947 to 1957, that 10-year period, 57 was actually the word starting to be used, there was a sharp contrast between these two families of fundamentalists. I'm going to still call them all fundamentalists. The fight-back style of these two entities was striking. Now, advance notice here, we could jump to the end of life. We could ask this question, but I wonder about this. We may wonder which of these caused, of these two guys, the soft-spoken one or the bellicose one, which of these two guys caused the most trouble for the gospel? I venture to say the bellicose guy did less damage than the one that was quietly spoken. Now, I don't blame it at Fuller's feet, but he set it up so it happened. So you wait with your judgment till we get to there. That's what next week starts, or less next week. So we have carried the banner across here. Who has access to the public airways? Because it forms the background of how these two families, believers, use two style asserting the gospel. Charles Fuller, a pioneer, had great success in penetrating the regulated radio market. He did nothing to put his ministry at odds with the government or his listeners. I'm sure there were complaints. Carl McIntyre is described in the title of a recent article as God's angriest man. Carl McIntyre, Cold War fundamentalism and right-wing broadcasting, which he started in 1955. By the way, he died in 2002, you know, he had 95. I think I said that somewhere. So he lived kind of almost into our time. I think 2000 is our time. Now it's already almost 20 years into our time. So the spoiler, is he the spoiler? Carl McIntyre. Again, we have McIntyre with his megaphone. God, yes. Communism, no. Typical, you know, mantra. So what might have been without Carl McIntyre? What about fundamentalism's failures? Fundamentalism tend to think that they are above the law, which is true. You know, we work through all this stuff as our church. So we obey the laws of the land. When they tell us not to park under the awning during service because the fire trucks can't get through here, we don't protest and say we have spiritual freedom not to park there. We obey the law. He says, don't park on the street. We don't park on the street. They tell, put sprinklers in your church building because it's a safety issue. We put sprinklers in our building. We don't argue about that kind of stuff. Some would, all right? So we know where we have to fit within the law. So the fundamentalists think they're always, the law's out to get them, the conspiracy theory idea. And the liberals use the law to reduce fundamentalists' access to radio opportunities, which is true. So we have an enemy there, a real enemy there, and not an enemy necessarily with natural laws of running a city. Now go back to early 1900s. We have Carl McIntyre and J. Gresham Machen. We're on the losing side of the modernist fundamentalist battle at Princeton University in 1929. This is after the Scopes trial, a little bit. It's part of that whole upheaval. They formed the Orthodox Presbyterian Church in 1936. 3 years later, McIntyre led a group out of the Orthodox Presbyterians to form the Bible Presbyterian Church. Now, does anybody know which of those two survives in Lincoln? They were, when we came to Lincoln, they were, both of those were here. One was on Randolph Street, about 47th and Randolph, on the south side of the street, little white building. And now the other one, I think it's the Orthodox Presbyterian that still exists, that's out on Warwick Road, across from where Christ's Place is. I think they're still there. So I think the Orthodox Presbyterian survived. They once said they went together, and they may have gone together, but the theology would not have meshed. So I don't know. Maybe one just died out. So maybe somebody can tell me if you know. So they formed the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. The 3 years later, the other one, the Bible Presbyterian Church, which was eschatologically a dispensational church. And that was McIntyre. He was dispensational. Machen was not. That's why, I'm sure partly why the split occurred. So we get the splitting. The groups get smaller and smaller. You know how this works. Rigidly fundamentalist, McIntyre and the Bible Presbyterians adopted dispensational premillennialism. We're against all consumption of alcohol and demand strict separation from anyone not adhering to fundamentalist standards. In fact, they probably carry to what we call a secondary separation. So if I separate from you, and if you don't separate from somebody else, I'm not going to be friends with you. So at that secondary level that some would practice, then one thing we never thought was right, or I should say necessary. So separation is always important. You know, you can't be in my orbit because you might influence me and mine. So the headquarters of this movement, McIntyre's movement, was in Collingswood, New Jersey. And that's why Gil knows a lot more about this stuff than I do, because he grew up in that area, where McIntyre also pastored local Presbyterian church. At that one time, in the 60s, was as large as 2,000 people. In 1941, McIntyre founded the American Council of Churches as counter to the Federal Council of Churches, which he considered too liberal. Agreed. McIntyre refused to join the National Association of Evangelicals, too liberal, probably agree, organized the following year because of what he considered the latitudinarianism, which is the ecumenical idea, policies, and its refusal to exclude members of the Federal Council. In other words, you could be a member of the Federal Council of Churches and be also a member of the NAE. He didn't like that. It'd be difficult for me to see both because they're really quite different. The Federal Council was definitely the liberal group. To expand his American Council, he now made an International Council of Christian Churches, gave some international standing for people from other countries. And when the Revised Standard Version was published by the National Council of Churches in 1952, McIntyre opposed it through numerous back-to-the-Bible rallies. Now, my brother was in a Bible class in, I think it must have been Henderson or else he would have had it, and the Revised Standard Version was used in that class, which is strange, and I know, remember, that the issue really with the Revised Standard Version was really on the word virgin or the young woman shall conceive or the virgin shall conceive. And then I think the RSV translated maiden rather than the virgin. And, of course, people that were on our side of it went ballistic. I'd say, well, it probably didn't make a lot of difference because it means the same thing. But because of that, the Revised Standard Version was rejected by the evangelicals. And here's just an example of that. And my brother wrote on the book from the Bible, says reference book. So he was told that it was not a good book, Bible either. And it's something that generally the conservatives have not used Revised Standard. We've had other alternatives. But as it is a pretty good translation, I haven't, Gil tells me. So some of you like to know all these names. Billy James Hargis. McIntyre became ferocious in his condemnation of communism, like Hargis, and his advocacy of patriotism during the McCarthy era. Postures he maintained long after the Red Scare had dissipated during the Vietnam War. He, as Harris Hargis, group led repeated marches for victory in Washington, D.C., supported the war effort. McIntyre, this is him, through his 20th Century Reformation Hour, a daily half-hour program, began in 1957. His publication, Christian Beacon, McIntyre disseminated his militant fundamentalism, basically against the modernists, mostly. I remember Bill James Hargis was in town one time. We were still living, we're just about to move to town. We were still living north on Lewis Street. I went to hear him. So he's not long gone, I'm sure. Well, militant fundamentalism. In 1963, McIntyre purchased the Admiral Hotel at Cape May, New Jersey, renaming it the Christian Admiral. He operated it as a Bible conference center and vacation hotel for his followers. With the purchase of the old minesweeper, McIntyre attempted to broadcast from it in international waters, 3 or 12 miles off. He didn't know which was the right one. He raised the ire of the government, but did little but make an embarrassing noise. It only lasted less than a day. And in the meantime, articles are written about him, and we have that over here, and I printed it out. If you want to read it, I have it for you. By the 1980s, McIntyre's extremist view had fallen somewhat out of favor, even among devoted fundamentalists and his institutions, notably Shelton College in Cape May. New Jersey had run afoul of tax officials, officially, unofficially, who knows why, in both New Jersey and Florida. McIntyre, however, still claimed loyalty of a core of devoted followers, died at 95 in 2002, with small groups still following him. I think Gil said it was like 20 people or something like that would show up on Sunday. Of course, when you're 95 years old, who wants to follow you? Or I might ask, how about 81? Now, the battle with the FCC and the fundamentalists. The paper written by Heather, entitled God's Angriest Man, is a current 2007 history piece of the struggles McIntyre had with the government and in energizing new evangelicals. And indeed, she claims that McIntyre was handed a biased end. And that's what he always claimed, but you know, how could you sort this all out? So she's had this page, or if you want to read it, I have that for you if you want it. So we won't take time to go through all of McIntyre's stuff. It's not worth it. We mention him here as one example. Now we have others like Billy Jim Hargis, Bob Jones, John R. Rice, Jack Hiles, later Jerry Falwell, we'll know about him, are other examples of those who used the direct approach to preaching the truth, any truth, all truth, in the same garb. Whether it's this or that, it's all the same for them. Now I don't know how to write this here, but it is hard to be hard on those outspoken advocates for the truth. Hard for me to be hard on those guys. What do you say when the house is on fire? Careful how you say it. Get them out of the house. You know, so you have this, you know, they see it from their point of view. So I'm thinking of that Romans 4:14 passage, which says each will stand to his own master. And I think that's going to be true. And that's why I asked the question before, who did the most damage? Or shall I ask it positively, which of these two families of fundamentalists did the most good in the long run? That answer waits to be given. So we come to a kind of a spot in our background of EDU evangelicals. And it was a good place to stop and reflect. So whether you're painting a masterpiece, a bedroom wall, or trimming the tree, which I was this week, it pays to step back and look at your work so far. And we need to do that here. There are two sides. I'm not talking about the fundamentalists and the modernists. I'm talking about the fundamentalists have two sides. There are two sides sketched, but there are many details that you don't have, and if you heard it once, you forget. All right, so lots of stuff missing here. So in our overall scheme of things, it helps to know, when you do this, step back, what do I expect out of that painting, that masterpiece, or how's that bedroom supposed to look, or how's that tree supposed to look when I'm done trimming it up? May just be a stump. That's not what I wanted. Whoops, I cut too many times. So we asked the question of Fuller as we developed his ideas in the future, or of McIntyre, what is your objective in ministry? And I expect that if you'd asked them, we'd have some expression about preaching the gospel so that sinners are saved. It's got to be in all of their, all their ideas. These are not liberal people. They're conservative, Bible-believing, gospel-believing people. So I expect that's what they would say. So now I'm stuck again. So now I go to my next, what if safety net? I kind of go to a historian that really knows this stuff. Now we need a good historian to answer the question informed by the philosophies and activities of these ministries and how they actually worked out. That's why you need a historian. We all do that. For example, if I say my ministry objective is to preach the gospel, if I say that, but at the same time you find me demonstrating for a higher minimum wage, you would have reason to think that my ministry objective or philosophy may include the gospel, but the truth is that I have also concerns about other things. And when you start mixing these together, it gets confusing. So what I say, gospel, may not agree fully with what I actually do. Therefore, a more honest evaluation of my ministry may be something else. That is why we need the historian. So let's try Joel Carpenter. I'm going to give you, I give this to you last week in my question and answer period, and I misspoke, so I got to give it to you right. The best book that I found on this, and I highly recommend it, I don't know whether he's a believer or not, he writes like he understands the issues, is Revive Us Again by Joel Carpenter. It is available, it's not out of print, kind of expensive, like $25 or something like that, but it is a great book. Because not only does it go over the fundamentalist battles, it takes us past 1930 into our modern day. And he is the guy that has pointed out the successes of the fundamentalists after the Scopes trial. We have other ones like Sandine, The Roots of Fundamentalism, but it only goes up to 1930. And then we have Marsden's. He got two or three books on fundamentalism that are good, but they're not as good as Joel. So Joel is my go-to guy here. So if you're going to look for a book, this is the one. I don't know if Twyla has these on the shelf or not, but she should. This is the one to have for this period, Joel Carpenter. So I'm going to use him for this next section. So we're going to step back to observe our masterwork. In the June 1947, Harold John Ockengay, and that is how you say his name, the pastor of Park Street Church in Boston. And when we were there, and what year were we there? 14? Huh? 14. We drove by his church. And it was like, that's Park Street. You know, no one said a word about it. Our guide didn't say anything about it. That's Ockengay's church. Well, there it went. Can't stop now. But anyway, it's a real place. Okay, Harold Ockengay, the pastor of Park Street Church in Boston, and the former president of the former president, 1947, born NAE, was formed in 1942. So he already is a former president of, he's been in the mix of the beginning of it, published a short article entitled, Can Fundamentalism Not Just Win, But Win America? Well, posing Protestant modernism, Roman Catholicism, and secularism as the three major contenders in a struggle for power for the dominant role in shaping America's cultural pattern, Ockengay bluntly told his readers that in its current state, fundamentalism could never win America. It was divisive and utterly incapable of cooperative action, and it stood aloof with a negative social ethic in an hour of crying social problems. Ockengay's purpose in mounting these criticisms in this article emerged only at the end of the article, where he pointed to a ray of hope for the winning of America, which was the spirit of cooperation, of mutual faith, of progressive action, and ethical responsibilities, which he saw in the NAE. Now, McIntyre reads this, and he goes ballistic. I'm just imagining. So on its surface, this article appeared to be nothing more than a brief commercial for the NAE, and perhaps one more occasion for Ockengay, who had been harassed by the leaders of the fundamentalist separatist wing like McIntyre, to contrast their foibles with the NEA's virtues. He's trying to, but that's not what it is. Well, maybe that's what it is. But really what happens is this article signaled what a new dispensation was beginning. Within the career of the fundamentalism, within fundamentalism, a progressive party was arising. and Akinge was deeply involved in the events that marked its birth. So, winning America. Now we have an objective. I say winning what kind of America? A Christian America, writ large. So it is likely that McIntyre and Akinge would agree on the gospel and the objective of winning America, the gospel. Akinge was dead on it. I mean, he was super, passionate for it. We're not dealing with an unbeliever here, as far as I can tell. So this disagreement was not about what we're going to do, it's just how we're going to win the cultural wars in American Christianity. Now, I wrote work on this quite a bit to say what I wanted to say, and I'm not sure it's still right. The idea of winning America by preaching Christ and winning America by keeping the neighborhood Christian is challenging to live out. Because when are you doing this and when are you doing that? Okay? When are you preaching Christ and when are you trying to keep your neighborhood Christian? Now, you don't want your neighborhood kids to steal, do you? You want them to come to Christ, don't you? Are these different? Are they the same thing? Can they be melded or are these totally always kept separate? Kind of a question. Now, we go through this phase, and I think behind this winning America, in all these phases, this is true, because I think we came into the 20th century with the idea of winning America, or that Christianity was American, America was Christianity, and they were hard to distinguish. So for evangelicals, there was an agreement on Christian America, even when moving through these phases that got us to our present time. So the ironic phase is that the warning phase. The fundamentalism was being warned, which is true. You know, liberalism is taking over. Stop it. You can't go that way. Then we have the militant phase with that turn against we have the monkey trial here. And then we have the divisive phase, which is now with McIntyre and others. Toward the end of this time, we have Akinge. They're sort of like start to fight each other. And we have the separatist phase after it's over. You know, it's sort of like the neo-evangelicals are over there and the separatists are left, the old fundamentalists. So, like I say, when I look at this part, I don't know where we fit with this diagram. We got to put a side margin, you know, are we part of this, whatever. So there is the Christian America counterpart, of course, always the modernist, which I'm not considering it. This is within the evangelical ideas of the gospel. Okay, what was brought into contention was the old fundamentalist way of doing things. Remember, all of them all had the idea there was a Christian America here somewhere. God bless America, right? And it's just hard to talk about this because that is how we think. And God has blessed America, is blessing America. What he's done with America over the last 100 years is absolutely incredible. But where does that fit? Now, be careful with that. See, that's the challenge. We must remember that success is the last lesson, the fundamentalist successes. There was no reason for the successes not to continue for the next half of the 20th century. Remember, if the neo-evangelicals would have kept their mouth shut, they would have kept on with their belligerence and been successful. No reason why they would not have. But since they interfered with this, now we had an intramural fight, and I'm not sure anything good came out of it because the neo-evangelicals went a way that was wrong because they started getting involved in other things in the gospel. So it was because of the forming of the NAE plus the neo-evangelicals that the fundamentalists aimed their militancy towards the insiders because they looked at Akinge as an insider. Look at certainly Fuller would be an insider. And they attacked them as compromised members, which in a sense was a form of discipline. So as I said before, twice already, it's hard to pick a good side here. Winning America meant one thing for the fundamentalists, which I think they would say God and country. Winning America meant another thing for the new evangelicals. We have God and country. We go to add culture. And the fundamentalists saw that in an attempt to save the culture, the gospel will be diminished and lost. That's true. So here we sit with our thumbs. It's a joke. I won't go into it. Our next section will deal with the happenstance that happens next in this thinking. That will bring about the forming of the leadership of, and it's remarkable. It's almost like God planned it. Well, think about this. One figure in the north, far northeast, as far as away as you can get, is Boston. If they go up to Maine, I guess. And the other extreme is the far southwestern corner of the United States and America. California coast is Fuller. So we had these two guys. They had airplanes that flew between these places, but, you know, it would have been quite a chore to fly from one place to the other place. So that's what we got to get into here. We got to start analyzing this real strange phenomenon that's going to be called the neo-evangelicals.